You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Supreme Court's lifetime appointments are meant to keep the justices' decisions from being swayed by public opinion. But research has shown that's not always how things work. A political scientist argues that low public opinion of the court may affect the current, highly controversial term. Now we're taking a look at where the U.S. economy stands. The latest jobs numbers show that millions of Americans quit their jobs in August, motivated by better-paying opportunities and an abundant job market, and hiring hasn't taken off as fast as hoped for. At the same time, inflation continued to rise. It's now at the highest point in over a decade. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How's the economy looking from where you're sitting? Have you joined the many other people who have left a job? What led you to leave? What are you looking for? If you're an employer, are you having a hard time employing people? And inflation, are you watching for it? Are you seeing higher prices? Is it affecting you, your pocketbook, your business? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. A pleasure being here.
Let's start with some new inflation numbers out today. I know you were eagerly awaiting them. And what they told us, what did they tell us?
Well, I think first, let's give the headline number, which was 5.4% year on year in inflation. And if you see some headlines, you'll see something like this is the highest in 13 years. One thing to keep in mind is it's certainly not the highest on record. You know, you go back into the 80s, you'll see inflation rates in 10, 12%. The other thing to remember is that's a year-on-year measure. You know, you're looking at the change over 12 months. In point of fact, on a monthly basis, so annualize the change from August to September, inflation's actually coming, well, it's slightly up from last month, and then it's slightly down from the month before that. And so on a month-to-month basis, you're actually seeing inflation trending downwards. So we don't have a straightforward picture and different indicators give you different measures. On the other hand, we have some indications that the inflation is more broad-based. Early on, we would have looked to prices of items that were in the sectors that were reopening. And so you would see, for instance, cars, used cars in particular, rebounding strongly. That effect has dissipated to some degree, and we're seeing new things pop up in terms of pushing up prices in general, like energy, for instance.
For somebody saying, okay, I'm getting paid X amount and I have to spend on these key things, energy bills, gas for the car, food, things like that, are we at a point where people are feeling a noticeable pinch from the levels of inflation?
Well, I think that very much depends upon where you're standing in terms of what sort of job you're in and what basket you consume. What's true is if you look at manufacturing, for instance, and I sort of draw a trend line from what happened before the pandemic to now, well, maybe you're not too far off the track. And in fact, manufacturing has come back a lot in terms of employment as well. So maybe that all makes sense. Where you've seen the biggest jump in recent months and where the real wage, that is an inflation-adjusted wage, is higher than it was before and higher than the trend, the pre-pandemic trend, is in, for instance, accommodation and food services. And so here, that's where you see a big jump in wages and wages after accounting for inflation. So those people, to the extent that they still have a job, or they newly moved into that sector, they're actually slightly better off than what you would have expected in terms of the trend. But once again, it really depends upon where you are in the economy, what sort of job you're doing, and what kind of bundle of goods and services you consume.
We're talking to UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin about some of the latest big economic news, focusing on inflation and jobs numbers. Pretty big pieces of the story there. You could join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Mike?
Back in July of this year, my company, we had been working from home for about 18 months, and my company decided that everybody had to come back into the office. I work in a tech job, and that's kind of difficult for me. I was saving $300 a month on gas. I was saving 10 hours a week or on commuting. And so I left that job for another job that was going full remote. And since then, I start a new job next week. And between that first job and my new job I'm starting next week, I've realized an increase of 60% in my income. And I'm working fully from remote from home. So I know it's kind of a tech industry thing, but it's definitely the right move for me.
All right. Congrats on the new gig, Mike. And Menzi, this is a part of the job story. Apparently, a lot of people doing what Mike's doing, quitting a job, and at least in some cases, going somewhere else that's maybe better paid. What are you looking for in the people leaving jobs to find new ones department?
Well, this is certainly part of the big story in terms of the labor market. I mean, typically we tend to look at the aggregate numbers, how many net new jobs are created in the economy. And in fact, in September, that number disappointed substantially. Mm-hmm. The headline number was less than half of what economists expected. But there's another big story, and that is the large number of quits or separations in the economy. And so that was like 6 million in August, and that's a record as far as I know. You know, that's signaling something. And on top of that, I guess the sectoral distribution signals something else. That is, a big number of the separations are in high contact services. And so that tends to suggest that a lot of people are, for whatever reason, not willing to take these high contact service jobs in, let's say, accommodation and food services or retail trade at the given wages right now, or they just decided this is not the job for them, and so they're leaving in record numbers. On top of that, I guess the high demand for labor, so I think job openings were something on the order of 10.5 million. That means that if you quit your job, the likelihood you can get another job is higher than it might otherwise have seemed. And so these things are pushing quits. On top of that, what's not quite knowable is, how much the pandemic has struck or affected this this development. So, for instance, some people might have to left their jobs because they've got childcare issues, which we thought would have been resolved perhaps with schools going back to in-person teaching fully, or they have difficulty getting childcare, or their care for the elderly that might be impacting, or just fear of working in circumstances where you've got lots of people you're coming into contact with who might not be vaccinated, so that you have a perceived higher likelihood of getting sick. So that is one of the big things that people are sorting themselves out of the jobs that they were in. And we don't know if they've gotten new jobs. We don't track that specifically, whether they've actually moved into a new job in the meantime.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll be talking more about the trend of people quitting their jobs over the last couple months tomorrow on Central Time. Now let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234 with Samantha in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just like, I work at a place called Styrene's in Arcadia, foam packing. And we have couple of our employees that are out sick with this COVID. And there's some that, we're not getting the people, like we used to before the pandemic. And we're always, we always have it in the paper that they're looking for, everything that you could name in a factory. And we're just not getting the people. And it seems like the people that I work in are getting stressed out, overworked. And what do you do there? How do you draw the people in? Because we do work in close proximity with each other. And if you don't know if they're vaccinated, because we don't have to wear a mask if we're vaccinated, but fully. But how do you know if you're, there's some of them that, you don't know for sure, and they could be, without a mask on. I know a couple that definitely aren't vaccinated, but don't wear the mask.
Samantha, thanks for the call. Samantha's bringing up a quandary, Menzi, that I think is facing a lot of workers in places where you're in close contact with others, as you were saying, and employers trying to bring people into that situation.
Well, once again, I guess this comes to the point that the labor force has shrunk to a certain extent, partly because of the pandemic. Just, certain people have decided that it's it's not worth the risk to be working at the given wages. So that's a problem both with the wages and the, I guess it's the personal choices on top of that. But on top of that, you've got a lot of shocks that have hit the system. So there are a lot of job openings. There are a lot of people who are still looking for jobs, but they may not be in the same industries. They may not be in the same location. And, you know, when you look at aggregate numbers, you miss that sort of thing. So I think what the experts who look at the labor markets are predicting, over time, some of these things should lessen in severity. That's certainly what we're hoping. And the reasons would be, well, first, you know, if you get the pandemic under control to a greater degree, so people don't have this fear of coming into work, well, that's one problem solved. If you can deal with problems of school-age children having to be taken care of when people are working, well, that would be another partial solution. If you can get enough workers in the childcare industry hired and employed so that you can provide safe childcare, yet another constraint on people taking jobs will be removed. There's also what's often been discussed, which is benefits were too high. Unemployment benefits were too high during the period of these extended or enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, the sort of the pandemic response. And those have all disappeared by now. Some of them disappeared several months ago. And yet the thing that we haven't seen is a big response in the states that cut these benefits early on. Now, what may be true is there's perhaps a delayed response. So several months after these benefits are gone, the enhanced benefits at least, then maybe more people will enter into the labor force. I wish I could say I know how much to apportion to each of these categories of influences, but I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Thanks again for that call. Menzie Chin is with us, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. We're looking at the latest jobs and inflation numbers. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing higher costs that are affecting you or maybe your business? What's your job scene? Have you left and found a new job lately? Call in at 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin, looking at the latest inflation and job numbers around the country. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences as an employee or employer. Call 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is about the money supply and our federal economy, our national economy. We just passed law, you know, in Congress. Biden signed an increase in our national debt. All of us consumers, as long as we're spending, I think we have the largest debt ever in terms of our credit cards and stuff. But as long as we're spending and the value of our dollar stays high, isn't really everything okay?
Interesting. Jeff, Menzie, what do you think?
Well, I economists are want to say there's always a trade-off. And so the fact is, in a crisis, you do want to, especially in the crisis where either you've got to support people so they can live, or you want to support total demand for goods and services so you don't have lots of unemployment, you need to take emergency measures, and you need to, and for the federal government, that means spending above the tax revenue that you get. And so you're running deficits, and as long as that's happening approximately, then you're going to be building up your national debt. Has that been a problem? Well, we built up the national debt over the past substantially as a ratio of GDP over the past 10 years, maybe even 15 years. And that hasn't had a big impact on either interest rates nor necessarily on the economy in general. So you might say all good and well. I guess the problem is, as the debt to GDP level grows and grows and grows, at some point you got to stabilize that number. You know, you don't want debt to increase forever as a ratio to GDP, because you're just becoming more indebted. So the question is, how do you stabilize that? And one of the things is perhaps you try to cut back on entitlements, or you try to spur long-term growth, or you do both. And so, for instance, the Biden administration is talking about investments, and you might say that's just jargon or for political consumption. But truly, if you want to boost, if you want to reduce the ratio of debt to GDP over the longer term, one of the best ways of trying to do it is to accelerate the growth rate and investment in infrastructure, investment in new technologies, and investment in the human capital people. We hope we'll do that. The other approach, which is just to cut spending wholesale and raise taxes, that might work, but more likely in recent past, it hasn't worked very well because you tend to throw the economy either into a recession or slow growth. The one plus we have now relative to the past is real interest rates, that is inflation-adjusted interest rates, are at really low levels. For 10-year, it's probably something like a negative 1 percentage point. That is, the real interest rates are negative. And so to the extent that real interest rates are negative for the federal government, this increase in debt is not as worrisome as if, for instance, the real interest rate were 3 or 4% as it was in the 1980s.
Thanks for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Looking at the big economic news, inflation and jobs, with Menzie Chin from UW-Madison. Menzie, with rising costs in at least some sectors, people are still pointing toward a supply chain problems, whether it's a whole bunch of goods sitting in boats waiting in queues, either in ports across the ocean or outside of LA. President talked about that today. People saying, hey, we can't get glass bottles to bottle whatever our product is. Do you see that as something that's driving costs up in selected sectors of the economy?
Well, definitely supply chain disruptions are important. And I think part of the problem in forecasting is, so the Fed in particular, but other forecasters had thought that this blip up in inflation would be a little less persistent, a little bit more transitory than it has turned out to be. Well, that's because we didn't anticipate these supply chain disruptions being so large and pervasive. And they're not just in America. I think that's one thing to remember. So we have problems getting things offloaded, the ships in the ports, and then put into trucks to drive off the port. So that's what the Biden administration has tried to do with respect to sort of increasing the throughput in the port system. Mm-hmm. But we also have these constraints elsewhere in the world economy. So, for instance, we have the chip shortages because the chip manufacturers in East Asia can't keep up with demand. And part of the problem elsewhere is that getting stuff out of East Asia, where a lot of things are produced, not just chips, but lots of sort of high, medium-level manufactured goods. Well, when, for instance, China shuts down a port because it's got a zero tolerance towards COVID cases, well, that's going to hinder the supply chain working in the way that it has typically worked. So we have a supply chain problem in the U.S. in terms of transportation of goods and in terms of getting all the inputs we need. But part of that is also happening in the rest of the world. And the reason is this interaction between the pandemic and also this rapid reopening of the economy in general, in the global economy, such that you get this sort of a perfect storm in a way of supply disruptions that we hadn't planned for.
And I wanted to ask you about that demand side of things. It isn't so much that people aren't producing enough stuff, and it isn't just that people aren't shipping enough stuff. It's that we're ready to buy stuff, right?
Well, we're ready to buy goods, that's for sure. And that's been true for a while. And now, depending upon where we are between the surges in COVID, we're ready to buy services. So yes, it's, demand seems to be there. Although you have to remember, we put in a lot of stimulus over the past year and a half. And a lot of that is going to be waning. I mean, it'll still be there, but the size of that stimulus is going to be shrinking so that you don't have this support to the economy that you did before. Now, back in April, when hopes were high, We thought we'd put in enough stimulus to let us sort of cruise on for a substantial amount of time with that demand in place. But given that we've got these constraints, some people not working, running down their savings, then that demand surge is waning. So it's interaction. I mean, once again, between how much we've got the supply shifting inwards, that is a reduction, how much prices have been bumped up because of higher costs, and then this demand that's shrinking overall. So we have lots of things moving at the same time, which makes it very hard to trace out exactly what's the dominant influences in pushing around the American economy.
Briefly, as you wrap up, Menzi, I'm hearing some people worried about inflation. If I'm reading you right, you're not that worried, at least not yet. Is there a point where you would see it as a worrisome thing?
So, we have to ask ourselves, why do we worry about inflation? Inflation is worrisome because it makes the decisions we undertake, like how much to save, how much to spend, how much to work, more complicated, especially if the inflation is uncertain. If it's certain, if it's stable in a way, then you're a little bit less worried. On top of it, higher inflation can be good for the economy to the extent that, well, if the inflation rate's on average higher, then wages are easier to move around to make sure you get the right adjustment. Interest rates can, in real terms, go lower than they otherwise would be. So it's the kind of inflation that you get. If it's highly uncertain and that makes decision-making hard for everybody, then that's a problem. So that's the concern. Now, what's true is the surveys of people say that inflation is going to be high for the next year, like 5-6%, whereas economists are much more sanguine, something much more closer to 3%. I'd say if you're going to 4%, 3%, 4%, and you've got accompanying elevation of uncertainty, that's a problem.
Menzi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison with us for a look at jobs and inflation numbers. Coming up, a political scientist tells us how public opinion can affect U.S. Supreme Court decisions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out what's behind a drop in the public opinion ratings of the U.S. Supreme Court. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about an animal sanctuary.
Primate research has led to countless scientific breakthroughs. But when a monkey is no longer needed for research, what happens next can be an ethical quandary. In South Central Wisconsin, a team runs a sanctuary for monkeys as a way to say thank you for their contributions to science. Jana Rose Slice brings us the story.
There's a small animal sanctuary tucked away in a quiet rural area in Marquette County. Here, you'll find 9 monkeys living in habitats close to their natural environment.
That's actually Bella doing a warning call, saying stranger danger, there's visitors today. But she likes to let the other monkeys know what's going on.
That's Amy Kerwin, executive director and founder of Primates, Inc.
And then Jojo on the right, he's a green monkey. He's just 1 year old.
The monkeys living here were former research animals or pets. Kerwin used to work with 97 rhesus monkeys in a University of Wisconsin-Madison lab. She loved caring for them as they were used for biomedical research.
You know, some labs don't want your employees to grow close to the animals, but since the monkeys are so like us, it's almost inevitable. You're going to grow close to them, so why not help facilitate and give a chance so they can give back?
Kerwin has set out to do just that. When an animal is no longer needed for research, it has few options. It costs thousands of dollars for one monkey's retirement care.
It costs just hundreds of dollars to be able to euthanize a monkey to free up their cage or sell them to more research than you actually make money. So the motivation to retire is an ethical compromise.
After learning about the barriers monkeys face getting into retirement, especially in Wisconsin, Kerwin decided to make a change. She started Primates, Inc. so the retired monkeys can live their lives as close to their wild counterparts as possible. It's also a way to thank them for their contributions to science. Fallon Mullen also used to work with monkeys in a research lab and is now the animal care manager at Primates, Inc. She's responsible for the day-to-day care of the monkeys.
This is Mars. Just turned 16, like I said. He is a rhesus macaque male as well, also from the biomedical industry, and he's paired with Timon, who everyone calls Sweet Timon because she's just so kind of timid and really, really sweet-natured.
Many of Primates, Inc. residents have never lived in their natural environment. Staff maintain greenhouses, raised walkways, and indoor and outdoor spaces for the monkeys. Mullen says this encourages natural behaviors like foraging, grooming, and playing.
But we've never seen a monkey actually swim. They'll sit in the pool. The pools are, you know, like either like kiddie pools that you would imagine or like turtle sandbox, you know, about that depth. So not real deep. But the monkeys in the past have, you know, like I said, just sat in them, waited in them.
But Mullen says that changed when a pair of surrendered pets showed up.
But Noah, who is a rhesus macaque male, he is paired with Maddie. We just gave them their pool this month, and he can be seen actually swimming. So he goes under the water and does several circles and will come up for air, and it's just so amazing to see because he didn't learn this from the other monkeys here. So this was just like his natural instinct coming out, and also such a great story about why monkeys should have the opportunity for retirement. It's just so amazing.
Kerwin hopes to grow Primates, Inc. to house 100 monkeys because she sees the impact retirement in a natural environment can have on former research animals.
Jana Roche Leiss brought us that story about an animal sanctuary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Now, public opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a turn for the worse in the last month or so. Gallup found that 40% of Americans approve of the justice's job performance, the lowest since Gallup started keeping track of public opinion of the court back in 2000. The Supreme Court's lifetime appointments are meant to shield justices from the ups and downs of public opinion and to allow them to make decisions based solely on their interpretation of the law. But some research has shown that in spite of that setup, the Supreme Court can be vulnerable to public opinion and to the possibility of the legislative and executive branches diminishing their power. We're talking about public perception of the Supreme Court and how it can influence justices' opinions, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. How has your opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court changed over the years? Is there a decision that made you appreciate it more or like it less? Do you think it should be insulated from polling and public opinion and not worry about the twists and turns of what people think about particular issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Savage is an associate professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago. Her research focuses on the Supreme Court and judicial decision making. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece in the Washington Post recently looking at these issues. First of all, can we start with what we think of the Supreme Court? What have we seen in the twists and turns of public opinion about the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. So what recent polling has suggested is that the court's approval rating is at an all-time low. Now, when we say all-time, we really only mean since the year 2000, because that's when Gallup started doing these polls on a regular basis. But the cautionary point there before thinking of, okay, everyone just distrusts the court now, is that these numbers tend to fluctuate a lot. So while maybe 40% of people who were polled approve of the Supreme Court now, those numbers were in the mid to high 40s during the late Obama years. They shot back up into the 50s, kind of in the early Trump years. They've been low before, and they tend to bounce back pretty regularly.
You also write about trust in institutions, and there the Supreme Court does pretty well, especially if you compare it to something like Congress, right?
Yeah, political scientists are careful to caution that there's a difference between approval of the court, which tends to reflect, do people agree with, you know, the whatever most recent decision the court has made, with kind of their long-term gut reaction of, I trust this institution, especially as compared to trusting Congress or trusting the president. And there, what we see is that the court is really resilient. It can make a lot of decisions that people disagree with. And while we might be upset with the court, we don't fundamentally trust the idea of the court less.
The court, in theory, is nine justices with their interpretation of the law, trying to take the Constitution and precedent and weigh each issue based on that. So, of course, public opinion doesn't have anything to do with it, except, you write, sometimes it might?
Yeah. And I think that that's surprising for a lot of people, because we kind of built this institution to be insulated from the public matter. And we kind of don't want our interpretation of the law to be influenced by what people think day to day. But justices care about their legacy. They care about their decisions being enforced. They care about a lot of factors that really require the public. And so when public trust or public approval in the court is low, the justices pay attention to that. And sometimes they'll change from their ideology or their judicial interpretation to rein themselves in to be more in line with the public. They don't want the public to lose trust in them.
Why is that? Is there something about, hey, if we get too far off of track with public opinion, there might be a threat to this institution we're part of if, say, Congress or the president think, yeah, we need to tackle some changes here?
Yeah. So, and there's a caution there. So the justices are concerned about either the decisions being ignored by Congress or the president because they're so out of line with public. Remember, the court can't enforce its own decisions. But they're also concerned about Congress or the president, or maybe both, retaliating. So right now, President Biden has instituted a commission to study the potential for judicial reforms, everything from the possibility of adding new justices to the court to potentially changing the Constitution to make justices' life tenure term limited. And the justices really don't want that to happen. The caution there, of course, is that a lot of those changes are hard politically. And the justices know that they're hard politically, so they feel pretty secure that even if the public is upset with them, that it takes a lot for the president to do something, for instance, to say pack the court.
One of the times we pay a lot of attention to the Supreme Court is when there's a vacancy in the court and an appointment. And this, of course, is a highly political event. It seems like whenever this happens, how much does that affect the public opinion of the court and maybe play into the mindset of that new justice who does get approved?
Well, vacancies are always really fun for people with my job because it's kind of the only time that the public pays really close attention to the court. And so my students watch C-SPAN and it's great for me. But research suggests, at least historically, that time period when everybody's paying attention is an opportunity for the court to actually shore up its legitimacy, that we see these justices sit at this table and refuse to answer political questions because they need to be above politics. And it kind of reinforces all the symbols that we think of the court as kind of above politics and only caring about the law. Now, that's changed in recent years. And now with everything from the controversy surrounding Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the delay of Merrick Garland and Eric Berg getting a confirmation vote, now the confirmation politics tend to politicize the court rather than depoliticize it. And that's scary, I think, for the justices.
Talking to Amanda Savage, Associate Professor of Political Science at Loyola University Chicago, looking at research on the U.S. Supreme Court and public opinion and the times when public opinion might influence the thinking on decisions of those justices. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court, the impact of politics on it, your questions for our guest. The number is 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Savage, Associate Professor of Political Science at Loyola University Chicago, looking at the impact that public opinion can have on Supreme Court decisions. what drives public opinion and why it can influence justices in some cases. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to ask the guest, it seems that the politicalization of the court really started with Robert Bork. I mean, he was a more than qualified justice. He just happened to have an interpretation of the Constitution that some people liked, in particular towards abortion. Isn't the abortion debate really what's driving the politicalization of the court? And isn't it better if we had maybe just, instead of a weak abortion decision, a really strong abortion decision on its constitutionality that would help the whole situation?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Abortion as a big part, Amanda, of public opinion toward the court, first of all. What do you think?
It's certainly the issue that I think divides most Americans about the court, and it's probably top of mind when people think about the court. When you think about whether or not you trust the Supreme Court or approve of the Supreme Court or are worried about the Supreme Court, you kind of, your first thought goes to, do I support Roe versus Wade or not? In terms of Robert Bork, yeah, there's definitely evidence to suggest that something changed after the Bork nomination, where if senators were voting based on their ideology to confirm a nominee before Robert Bork, they might have still been doing it. And there's evidence to suggest that they were. What happened after Bork is that senators started using it and being open about the fact that ideological agreement with a nominee was a good reason to vote for or against a nominee. And so we see kind of the Senate being a lot more okay acknowledging that justices or potential justices have ideologies that they should care about, even on abortion.
Now let's step into the minds of Supreme Court justices as best we can. Are they thinking about public opinion when, say, a big abortion case comes from Texas or Mississippi and thinking, wow, if I make a particular decision, this could shake faith in the court or politicize it somehow, if this is possible, even more?
I think it probably depends on which justice's mind you're stepping into. I think that John Roberts cares deeply about the institution, both his own personal institutional legacy and kind of what the front page of the New York Times looks like the day after the court overturns Roe versus Wade. And I think that his decision-making is probably guided a lot by taking a more narrow approach to avoid the big splashy headlines and the dragging the court into controversy. But there are justices on the court that I think have very strong personal beliefs about Roe in both directions who probably care a little less. And for instance, I don't think that Clarence Thomas is particularly concerned with what's said about him or the court and the media.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Terry now in Green Bay. Terry, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, the ultimate public opinion is obviously the vote. And the last, I think, I do believe the number is five of the most recent justices appointed were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote, but they won the Electoral College. So that ultimately, I think, sways a lot of stuff when it comes to, you know, and then the role of the Federalist Society these days with justices and, you know, those being nominated.
Thanks for the call, Terry. I don't know the exact numbers, but that would apply to three Trump appointees. I'm thinking a couple of George W. Bush appointees. What do you think? Should we measure the impact of Supreme Court justices, the legitimacy of the Supreme Court justices, based on lack of popular support for the presidents who appointed them?
I'm not sure if we should or we shouldn't. What I can tell you is that the public doesn't seem to. Mm-hmm. That even after Bush versus Gore decided the 2000 election, you would think that public trust in the court would have gone down in some way. Like kind of this, should the Supreme Court really be deciding presidential elections? And the answer is actually no, that there was maybe a slight dip immediately following Bush versus Gore, but kind of that same latent level of trust that we have for the Supreme Court wasn't much affected by it. And so maybe it should be affected, but the public doesn't seem to care.
Terry, thanks for the call. Going out to Jim in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I do think the Supreme Court has been exposed. They do not have really any teeth. If you look at the rent moratorium that they told President Joe Biden not to do, he just came up with different wording and it goes back into the courts. I mean, ultimately, they just can play games with the Supreme Court, and really there's no enforcement there as far as I know. And also, they did not want to get involved in the election. They didn't want to decide the election. They stayed and ran far away from that when we really needed them. And I think they lost a lot of confidence. I think the whole system lost a lot of confidence when that came about. And yeah,
so, I'm sorry, you're talking about the last year's presidential election, the Supreme Court not intervening?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, I believe they should have took it up, but I know I'm not, you know, I know that's just my opinion,
sure.
But they really lost a lot of faith.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. And that makes me think, Amanda, when we see the court approval going down at any point, it might be a conservative wishing that the court had overturned the Affordable Care Act, say, or intervened in the election last year. And it could also be people on the left worried about the impact on abortion or rulings on campaign finance laws. They could be losing support kind of on both ends, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what more recent scholarship has found is that while we kind of have this like deep underlying gut level trust in the court, that really can be hampered by disagreement with decisions. Not maybe not just like one decision or two decisions. Mm-hmm. We tend to forgive them. But on either side of the aisle, if the court kind of either consistently does things that we dislike, or we feel like it's consistently doing things that we dislike, that can really hamper trust in the institution over time. And I think that that's what the justices are concerned about now, that kind of both sides are upset with the court.
Now we've seen, thanks for that call, by the way, Jim, we've seen justices who we might consider on left and right, Amy Coney Barrett, for example, Stephen Breyer, saying and making a point of saying to the public, hey, we are motivated by our judicial philosophy. We are not Democratic and Republican justices. I don't know. It seems like we're hearing that more lately from justices. What do you make of their sort of PR campaign?
Well, that's actually the thing that struck me the most about this news. The Gallup poll, I don't think was particularly surprising. How the justices responded to the Gallup poll was the thing that I took notice of. Justices don't tend to go on kind of PR goodwill tours. And we see from Stephen Breyer across the ideological spectrum to Amy Coney Barrett, they're worried. And it might be the presidential commission. It might be that they're reading the same polling data that we are. But the fact that they're going so far out of the way to try to talk the public out of, no, we're not political, I think is both a sign of maybe an institutional legitimacy crisis, or also they know as much as we do how controversial this upcoming term is going to be, and they're trying to kind of soften public feelings before they issue some, I think, really hard opinions.
And briefly, Amanda, give us a preview of some of the high-profile cases that are coming. We've mentioned one or two of them so far.
Absolutely. So the court is going to decide a ban on abortions after 15 weeks coming out of Mississippi, which the legal question in that case really has the possibility of overturning Roe versus Wade if the court chooses to go in that direction. So there's a pretty major abortion case coming. There's a case coming out of New York about the right to own and carry a gun outside of the home. So there's a pretty major interpretation of the Second Amendment. There's some hot button immigration cases coming. There's a couple of religious establishment clause or kind of the ability of public funds to pay for, say, private religious schools. Kind of all the things that get people rallied about the court are all coming up this term.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Amanda Savage, Associate Professor of Political Science at Loyola University Chicago. Her research focuses on the U.S. Supreme Court and on judicial decision-making. She talked to us about public perception of the U.S. Supreme Court and how it might, in some instances, make justices think twice about how they rule on controversial issues. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, in the face of possible extinctions, biologists want to create a bank of genetic material from threatened species. Find out why and how it might work tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. then Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is facing some backlash from his own party after a deal last week to help Democrats raise the debt ceiling for now. We'll talk about that and more. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. Follow these conversations anytime at WPR.org, stream live, or go to the archives and find out what you missed. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.